I thought I might read a little bit more from Ajahn Sucitto, Rude Awakenings, Chapter 10, entitled The Treasure House. Onward to Hajipur. Hajipur, Hajipur. Some crazy man was jabbering at us, and I threw the words at him as a desperate offering. He wasn't the only one accosting us, of course. Kahaja Rahai, they asked. Hajipur. That dumbfounded them for a while. My Hindi wasn't that good, but probably the next question meant, why on earth are you going to Hajipur? We just grinned. That's where the bridge over the Ganges began. Maybe. Nick couldn't get the maps to tally. Onward our path narrowed in the darkness as it wriggled between baked mud walls, the walls that defend the backyards of villagers' houses against thieves and wild animals. And still we crept onward, feeling like fugitives because of those walls, beyond them evening oil lamps and smoky smells mingling with cooking and burning dung, looking for somewhere to lie down in the darkness. Funny the details that stick. We both remember the cycads where we unrolled our bedding. How do you call them again, Nick? Cycads, Bhante, cycads, pronounced cycads. A very primitive form of plant, them, or something pretty like them, would have been around with the dinosaurs. Really, cycads. Cycads. I think I was starting to crack up. Fixing all these details in my memory seemed important. It gave a brief mooring to an attention that is losing its customary bearings. Like my mother. In my last anxious visits before leaving England, her mind was deteriorating. What time is it? Was her constant refrain, repeated every minute or two. Age is brutal at exposing our instinctive need to hold reality in a mesh of words. It doesn't matter, Mum. But it did. Each time would be carefully written down, relating to nothing but the need to keep track. Younger minds can put a little more flesh on the bones of our insecurity. They can go onward to the next memory. That interminable bridge. Hey, there's the bridge already, chirped the mind. Patna's just over the other side, nearly there. What other side? For the first hour, we didn't even get to the river. By the time the shimmering goddess appeared way below us, everything in me was dissolving and bobbing together. The shaking legs, the breath, and the mantra, driven onward by a flagging will. Mother Ganga was flowing effortlessly and timelessly east, west to east, the way in which the earth's turning creates our time. Boats rocked peacefully in her jeweled hands, not onward but on, borne on the ceaseless tide. Staggering onward. Onward to what? But still, better not stop now, at least get halfway over, then we'll have a rest. Halfway along that uncaring treadmill was the stop. We were midway between the banks. Stop. I rolled the delicious word around my mouth, savoring it like water ice. Get the bag off, sit down on the pavement beside the lane. Here at the intersection of time with the timeless, Buddha Puja. We laid down mats, set our Buddha image on the lower step of the parapet in front of us, and offered incense to the awakened one. Offered it also to Mother Ganga and the eternal cycle, a vast interweaving mandala of mud and refuse, and of a light so dazzling my eyes could hardly look at it. From her, people derived their livelihood and faith. It was the place of their spiritual purification, an open sewer and a graveyard. Ganga, a goddess descending from Vishnu through Shiva's hair, was the span of life itself. No wonder she was hard to cross over. The few minutes of meditation were terminated by something thumping into me. It was Nick scrambling to his feet. An ox cart was bearing down on us only a few feet away. Jai Ram bobbed into focus again. As we jumped onto the lower step of the parapet clutching our bags, and a train of oxen trundled by, the driver clucking and whooping at his beasts, probably wondering where we had sprung up from. So onward. More as fugitives than devotees, but onward. A white, onion-shaped dome, bluish in the morning light and misty, shone from the other shore. That must be a Sikh temple, the mind chirped again. Rest, hospitality, food, not far now. But the road marched on and the Ganga knowingly danced. Because, having crossed over the river, the bridge was in no hurry to merge into the maze of streets. It soared disdainfully over the rooftops that clung to Mother Ganga's sleeve and continued heading south. We had to abandon it. Finding a blocked-off stairway winding down the side of one of its legs, we ignobly clawed over the barrier to climb down to the world below. The white dome had disappeared. We had decided to stay in a Sikh temple, or Gurdwara, while in Patna. Religious places seemed far more appropriate than cheap hotels. There were dharamsalas in the city, but local people had repeatedly and emphatically warned us against using them. They were dirty and were full of thieves, and Patna was a lawless city. We should be very careful where we stayed. Sikh Gurdwaras, however, have a reputation for hospitality, and Patna had the largest outside of the Punjab. Nick's simple guide to the city indicated Sri Hari Mandir Sahib, the main Gurdwara, somewhere off in the east. So there was another journey, more churning in the flow. Buses, rickshaws jangling at one's heels, scooter taxis rasping like frenzied ducks, until in a wall, way beyond the hope of getting anywhere, a gate lay open. Here was the Gurdwara, quote, the gateway of the Guru. It was an impressive place. Huge gates opened onto a vast plaza of polished white paving surrounded by the stone walls and balconies and galleries of what must have been offices and lodgings. Onion-shaped fluted domes rose above the gateways in each wall of the square. The eye's attention, however, was rightly drawn to the center, to the temple building itself, square and built in the Mughal style, with characteristic domes and with windows with balconies that looked out over the plaza. The Sikhs must be well organized. There was an order everywhere that seemed un-Indian. It was shocking to see a set of buildings so homogeneous and in good repair, with plenty of space in the square, no chaotic crowds, no dogs, cows, or tea stalls, no rubbish, no strands of hunched bodies squatting over wares, no blaring Bollywood soundtracks. We stood for a while and took in the space. It looked like a good place to rest. Furthermore, the little chap by my elbow, looking up with shining eyes from his massive beard and turban, couldn't have been nicer. He wore the uniform of a guide and welcomed us in, presenting his card, Ram Ratan Singh, Temple Guide. We covered our heads with cloth and removed our sandals, as was expected, and explained our interest in the holy place and our wish to stay a couple nights. He beamed and indicated the nearby reception outside, which he would wait while we booked in and offered to show us around afterward. The man inside was larger and less affirmative. He took us to the director, who was larger still and distinctly negative. No, foreigners are not allowed to stay. Back to Ram Ratan Singh, then back in again to witness a heated debate between David and Goliath. Nowadays, Goliath wins. I needed to sit down and eat and made suitable noises. Ram Ratan Singh took us to a cheap hotel across the road, muttering about the director. Nick was explaining that we would have liked to stay in a temple and absorb some of the religion. We were pilgrims. His companion was a monk, and a monk should stay in a holy place. The hotel manager, the new ear for Ram Ratan Singh's tirade, waggled his head sympathetically. I got into the unmemorable little room and sat down. Nick had the energy to operate in terms of purpose. He determined to go off and do business-like things, first of which was to get a bag full of takeaway snacks from the street and offer them to me. Then, with an I'll be back later, he marched off to duty. My afternoon ritual was to unpack the bags, sort the stuff out, then write some memories in the diary. Unpacking wafts perceptions into the mind. The Buddha Rupa from the Cambodia Trust, I placed it in the only high place, the ledge where the brick wall was capped by a wooden window frame, and the ravages of Cambodia drifted to the surface. Here was the small stainless steel alms bowl that Jayasaro had sent me from Thailand for the trip. Here the bag that the bhikkhus at Amaravati had sorted out, with all kinds of straps and buckles with which to hold on my sleeping mat. Vajiro's sleeping bag, the belt patch that Suviro had made for me, the shiny stainless steel mug that a novice had given me, the sandals revamped with old motorcycle tires glued to the soles to sustain 1,000 miles of walking, and the relics, tiny crystals, fragments, and icons from shrines, those revered crumbs to offer to the shrines at holy places so that the aspirations of my fellow samanas would merge into this pane of homage. But the rubbish. There were no cupboards or shelves, so everything was awash on the floor. Rubbish and valuables distinguished only by emotional resonance. Here next to the relics, a fragment of a Hindi newspaper that the snacks had come wrapped in. Here a crushed matchbox. Here the mangled stub of a candle. Indian hotels never have waste paper baskets. You just throw the rubbish on the floor and someone sweeps it up every day or so, or when you leave. It's hard to throw things on the floor. The mind is so used to setting things apart. This is valuable, it goes here. This is rubbish, throw it away. But here there is no throwing away because there is no away. In India, it's all here, all rubbish, all sacred. And so with the perceptions and memories. What makes up a pilgrimage? What do you put in a diary? The gritty gray stone shower stall, water was available when no one else had a tap on. The two men wearing Nehru caps slouched in armchairs behind newspapers in the foyer. Or between Vaisali and Hajipur, the traditional graffiti-like paintings on the sides of the houses. Or the bund huge banyan trees. Often with a simple shrine, a stone, a swash of red paint, a strand of dead flowers, or some more momentary ripple, a white ox shaking its dripping muzzle at its feed, the light scattering through the drops of water, or the groan and clatter of a pump where we squatted to wash, or a small boy solemnly talking about Charles Dickens as he walked along with us. Or the smoky sunsets that we lumbered through as people withdrew into huts and houses and women's voices murmured through the walls. And the chilly evenings. Two mats around a tree somewhere and a faltering puja to introduce us to the spangled night's darkness. So many wavelets of memory. So many fragments born on the tide. On, but not onward. When I caught some and put them in the diary, they became so much debris. All rubbish, all sacred. I doubted whether Nick's hundreds of photographs had done much better. You might as well try to net a river. But even a poor man has to have his treasures. Later in the afternoon, I returned to the Gurdwara. Ram Ratan Singh took me around to his room, maybe 2.5 by 3 meters of space, containing his smiling wife and four sparkling-eyed children, a bed, a stove, a cupboard, and under the bed a photograph album. Here was Ram with the President of India, also a Sikh. Here was Ram solemnly with other VIPs who stirred no memories in my mind. I gave him one of the photos of Nick and myself and one of the cards that someone had given me as a joke, Venerable Sujito Bhikkhu, in copperplate, and underneath it, in small capitals, Alms Mendicant. He was pleased. I was pleased. You realize you need this stuff in order to be able to make the invitations and the blessings, the gestures that count, and to see the richness. For him, what was unnoticeable, but which I carried away like a jewel, was the invitation into his life, and the perception that here was a family of six, cheerful and bright, yet living in one room, most of which was bare. In the evening, I was with Nick in the white space of the Gurdwara. The place was gently throbbing with the evening kirtan. Two men, one on a harmonium and one playing tablas, singing verses from the Adi Granth. The attention of a scattering of human forms was held in its flow. Wrapped in so much cloth, the men and the women all looked huge, and their relaxed stillness gave them dignity. Nick, red-bearded, his head wrapped in a cloth, looked like a Sikh, albeit some cousin from Mars. They all seemed easy, flowing along in the spirit, and maybe even in the verses of Kabir, Guru Nanak, Guru Angad, Guru Amaras, Guru Ramdas, Guru Arjan. As with Buddhism, this spiritual outflow had started informally, not from a wish to create a new religion, but simply to purify and point to the truths and to the false grasping in current practices and ideas. Like Buddhism, the way of the gurus had sprung from the mystic source of personal revelation that keeps bubbling up through the crust of Vedic Brahmanism, and from which religious forms get deposited like silt. Sometimes it's the conflict between religions that cracks the crust. In the first half of the 15th century, when Islam was establishing itself in northern India, Kabir, a Muslim by birth, took discipleship from a Hindu guru and saw beyond the form of established religion. Quote, "There is nothing but water at the holy bathing places, and I know that they are useless, for I have bathed in them. The images are all lifeless, they cannot speak. I know, for I have cried aloud to them. The Purana and the Quran are mere words. Lifting up the curtain, I have seen." Kabir gives utterance to the words of experience, and he knows very well that all other things are untrue. That was the beginning of the flow. A few years later, Nanak had a revelation while immersed in a river and picked up the same theme. God is formless, not Muslim, not Hindu, then wandered, singing it. Those who heard and took Nanak as their guru became his disciples, learners, or in the Punjabi language, Sikhs. For 500 years since, the sayings of Nanak and subsequent gurus had been recited and venerated as the Sikhs' contribution to India's treasury of teachings. But the next day we went in search of another kind of treasure. Jalan House was what we had come to see, a private museum that one could only enter with the permission of Mr. Jalan himself. And yesterday, the incomparable Dr. Scott had tracked him down to one of his jewelry stores. "Yes, and if I am not there, my son will show you around." The son was 14 years old, from St. Paul's School, Darjeeling, courteous and accomplished. And the house? Probably 100-something years old, struggling against the corrosive effects of nature and the Indian state. It had been fine under the British, but since independence, some of the collection had been grabbed by the state. Then there was tax and the cost of servants. It was hard to keep it all going. And surely there was a lot of stuff here to hold on to. Wonderful old instruments, sitars and tambura and vinods, coins from all ages, a sizable collection of Chinese porcelain, and ivory Kuan Yins. Here, with a nonchalant wave of the hand, was a fine-tooled silver scabbard of Emperor Akbar's sword. Here, Napoleon III's bed. Here, George V's dining set, matching plates, bowls, saucers, and so on. Carved chess pieces, old manuscripts, the Prajnaparamita Sutra in Devanagari script, time's fragments. And really now there wasn't time to see it all. Various daytime duties, school, work, and so on were dawning. Outside the house, we said goodbye. And we have an old demlar from before the war, but the servant lost the keys, so we can't get in it anymore. Slimy lanes seethed around the stump of the wealthy estate. They had deposited contemptuous mounts of refuse, human, animal, and vegetable, against its grand aging walls. Patna was weary and under curfew. Too many deprived people in the city. Ayutthaya was still simmering. Everything was bright for that moment. Everything was still. Nothing was said. Nothing thought. The Buddha's ashes. His last words told in my mind. All conditioned processes are transient. Practice with diligence. But for a few precious moments, there was the light. That's all I needed to see. After the Buddha's ashes, who could be interested in looking at more remains? Apparently, somewhere in Patna, various sites had been excavated to reveal its glorious past as the capital of the Mauryan Empire, but such things seemed irrelevant now. All conditioned processes are transient, and the deepest irony was that in India the incarnate had lasted longer than the Sangha of the Buddha's heirs, and the legacy of his teachings. Pointlessness descended. Here I am, a lone bhikkhu following a long dead history. Where am I going? Now my right foot asked for attention. The blisters had all gone, but the strap of my right sandal had chafed a sore on the upper surface of the foot. Before we set off for our trip to New Patna, I had put a sticking plaster over it, but inadvertently created a slight tuck in the skin. In the course of the afternoon, the skin had torn open. You don't think that skin does that until you live in India. And opened into a sore about a centimeter across. No big problem, but I knew from past experience how slowly things heal in India. It requires a sustained effort to keep the flies out and a regular bombardment of medicines to prevent further infection. And this was a foot, bound to get dirty and required to do a lot of duty in a hostile environment. Hence, I wound several layers of white cloth around it and, suitably turbaned, returned to the Gurdwara. In the cool of the following morning in that holy space, a renowned preacher was expounding the Adi Granth. As the teacher was blind, a priest would beautifully intone a few verses from the sacred text, always about the same length. As he completed his last phrase, the preacher began his commentary in less formal cadences, but also softly modulated and of equal length. No, this was no talk, it was a dialogue, a few threads of the Sikh epic woven with the rhythm and harmony of a song, between the main theme of the priest's intonation and the counterpoint of the preacher's commentary. The congregation was rapt. When you have harmony and attention, songs don't need music. For me, it was like witnessing two late-night jazz musicians soulfully exchanging phrases of one of those standards that reach back into a shared place of feeling. The audience was right there with them, sharing in the much-heard song of their people. Occasional smiles, keen attention. We've heard it all before, but tell it like it is. Upstairs, above the flow, the vision was less convivial. Many of the exhibits came from the time of the conflict between the Sikhs and the Mughals in the 17th and 18th centuries. This conflict had molded much of Sikhism, giving it its characteristic forms and identity, and through that formalization fixed it as a separate faith. Without the antagonism of the emperors, Sikhism would probably occupy the same position in the culture as Sufism in Islam. Opening to the present is the only sane ground. Fittingly, the last scene in Patna was back on that lake-like ground floor of the Gurdwara, where Ram Ratan Singh met us and steered us into the dining hall for the langar, the communal meal that is one of the oldest Sikh traditions. Roti and dal were served to all, and we sat on the floor in the sacred fraternity of eating, a sangha of sorts, through the gateway at last. That was a suitable time for leaving. We were heading for Nalanda, not directly, the way of the main road, but via a road heading south toward Bir. Nick felt that if we headed down that road, he could find a way of cutting across country that would make the walk more pleasant. Ram was delighted. His cousin lived somewhere down that road at a place called Baldrachik. He wrote a note to his cousin, gave it to Nick, and walked along with us for a way. We left him in a Sikh jewelry store owned by one of the elders of the temple committee, campaigning again about the lack of hospitality shown to us, Jai Ram. By the side of the road toward sunset, another puja. Afterward, I noticed how pleasant it was to be sitting in a field carefully using a needle to get a splinter out of Nick's foot. It seemed like one of the more sacred acts that I had undertaken in the last month. After dark, the walking was still flowing on. Some fellow driving a tractor stopped and jabbered at us excitedly. Same old stuff about danger and bandits. Baldural Cheek, we threw at him, half crazy with walking, and went on. Baldural Cheek the beautiful, city of our dreams, we joked. Baldural Cheek, whoever went to Baldural Cheek? In Nalanda, Rajgir and Bodh Gaya, more dreams destined to become memories. Yet I plodded along, one foot shrouded in bandages and carrying a few less ideas. All right to be stupidly plodding in stupid Bihar. Was this the way to follow the Buddha? Who knows?
Comments, questions?
I particularly like the way Ajahn Sujito was able to capture the kind of chaos that is India, especially when you're walking and plugging in. You don't really know what's going to happen, how it's going to come out. And he's able to articulate that really, really quite nicely. Flatlands where Ajahn Jayasaro and I actually started our pilgrimage. I mean, we landed in Calcutta, which was a bit of an adventure because we were supposed to catch a flight on to Benares, and Air India was on strike, so I had no idea. But we managed to, then following day, we managed to get on a flight to Patna, and we landed right around late afternoon, and then started walking, and Patna goes on forever, and you just keep plodding and plodding and plodding. We managed to get out of the city quite late, and then we ended up spending the night in a Muslim graveyard with a shrine that we, it was a bit out of the way. Still got chewed up by mosquitoes, but yeah, it's you have a sense of having no idea what you're doing, where it's gonna end up. You have a plan, but the plans don't mean much. It's sort of head off in a particular direction.
You didn't have a layperson with you on this trip?
No.
Oh, so you were just all driving?
Yeah. It's just Ajahn Jayasaro and myself. We particularly wanted to do that. We didn't want to have a layperson at all. And just wanted to see what would happen.
How long were you working for?
About a month. That was because I was the abbot, he was the assistant abbot, so we had to Ajahn Purusa was willing to look after Nanachan for 1 month. We had a month to be away.
Why didn't you just take the bus? I know you took the bus from Tabokaya or something, and Ajahn Jayasaro wouldn't take the bus because he needed out of town to walk.
No, it was after Bodh Gaya.
Okay.
We got to Bodh Gaya, and then we got to Bodh Gaya, and it was like full moon. And then he wanted to, he said he'd made it out of time to walk the whole way. And I was sort of, I didn't make it out of time. And because I really wanted to stay in Bodh Gaya and do pujas. Because Ajahn Jayasaro only spent one night. And Trigger John, it's because it would be quite a ways to disarm us. sort of calculating this, I better get going. So I wanted to just keep doing pujas. So I did. And then I stayed for several days and was going to the jetty and do pujas and meditate.
But they just let you on the bus, you didn't? How did you get on the bus?
The bus was it wasn't a bus that I traveled on. There was this guy who saw me going to doing pujas every day, and he's a Indian guy, well educated. He had a small business in Bhutan, and he really wanted to follow me, and I said, well, I don't want anybody following me. And so he was, but anyway, it's as can only happen in India. I mean, no was not really in the vocabulary. So I said, well, I'm leaving, and there's a bus. Thai pilgrims were leaving, and I was on the bus, and I was going to just ask them to drop me off somewhere along the road, so I just had a bit of a head start, and the bus was just about ready to leave, and then he showed up and said, well, I got tickets for you, thank you on the train, and we can. So anyway, I ended up taking the train and then got to halfway along the way between Bodhgaya and Sarnath.
Do you find any of the particular holy sites especially affecting?
Sarnath was I found very, very peaceful. And Bodhgaya is to me is kind of the epicenter. But I mean, you've been there. It's quite a. It's always something happening, and that has its own kind of flavor. But I did go to all the holy sites. I mean, we were walking. So, Nalanda, Rajagir, Vulture's Peak, Bhutai, Sarnath. I found Sarnath really. I love meditating in Sarnath. It's really, it's very peaceful. And of course, it's where the Buddha gave his first discourse. And that was when I first memorized I was on that pilgrimage, so I memorized the Dhammacakka Satipatthana. So that was kind of a combination.
I've heard different sort of opinions on whether it's still safe to go pilgrimage on foot in India.
Yeah, I mean, I think, even when we were there, nobody encouraged us to be out. Just a lot of bandits, no, Bihar doesn't really have a functioning government. So it's pretty chaotic. And of course from then, and yeah, from population of India's doubled since I'm at least, if not more. So that you've got twice as many poor people and bandits in Bihar now. So I can imagine it's pretty chaotic. People were very, very concerned for well-being, and that was whether they were Hindus or Buddhists or Muslims, everybody was very concerned and made sure that we were didn't stay out, and there was quite enough places to usually there'd be we stayed in many different places. I came up Barnes and in school, in schools and shrines, Hindu, close to Hindu shrines everywhere. So that so it's always enough to get a quiet corner. But I mean, comparatively, in the sense of, you know, India is always a gazillion people.
Did you get sick? Did you get sick at all?
I did. And it was that person who wanted to follow me, and then we arrived, and he wanted to offer a meal, and that was the only restaurant food that I ate, and I got sick. Sort of both hands. And but alms round, always receive food and water. It's always from wells. They never had a problem.
It would strike me that if you separated from Ajahn Jayasaro, the only chance you might see him again would be in Thailand. Like, how would you like connect with somebody again in India? It seems like.
We set up to meet in Sarnath.
Is it like you could actually see another? I mean, is that chaos, or is it a little more open there? Maybe you might be able to spot somebody.
Oh, we had a place set up.
Oh, okay.
There's a Thai temple in Sarnath. So we said when we were in Nalanda, we arrived in Nalanda, and you know, we'd been on the road for several days. We were tired, blisters, I mean, you know. So we thought, oh, well, let's spend an extra day at Nalanda and rest up. And we were looking forward to getting, there's a Thai temple in Nalanda, and looking forward to sort of resting up. And we got there, and the abbot didn't want to receive us. didn't have a place for us. Said there was, you know, they had two groups coming, and they just didn't have any place for us to stay. Okay. So anyway, we talked with them back and forth, and we ended up staying in some kind of a shrine. I don't know if there was, you say, call it a Uposatha hall, probably, a big ground. But it was some kind of a shrine in the temple. So we spent the night, and then we heard people arriving in the night. And so that was the first thing. We got up in the morning, you know, go out to brush teeth, and ran into a Wattapong monk. He had a group from north of Thailand, Zajin Kuan from Chiang Rai. And so he had a group that he was traveling with, and a couple of his monks. So started talking with him, and he said, "Oh, you know, Ajahn Chai came last night as well. There's another group." And as Ajahn Chai was a monk from Chonburi, who's a Mahani Kai monk, he wanted to offer his monastery and his branch monasteries to Ajahn Chai. I had a lot of respect for Ajahn Chai. He was contemporary of Ajahn Chai. So we went and paid respects to him. We were chatting and talking. And then, of course, they're asking, you know, what are you guys doing here? Having so, well, we were walking. And told the story about getting, you know, having to, you know, we had our flights arranged with them. We ended up having to take a flight to Patna, just because that was the only flight was going. And they said, and so they said, "Well, how are you going to get back?" And I said, "Well, we've got a return flight from Patna. So how are you going to get back from Patna?" Because we were going to walk to Sarnath. So, "Oh, I don't know." So they kind of kind of pastor on behalf amongst all their people, and then said, we're going to be going to Sarnath. We'll leave this money at the temple at for your tickets to go. And when you get there, you can organize those tickets. So I told Ajahn Jayasar, I'll get to Sarnath a couple days early, and I'll organize the tickets. So you just make sure you get to the temple.
So you actually ran into him on the way. Somehow you found him. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you found Ajahn Jayasar on the way to Sarnath. Still.
No. He walked. He walked all the way to Sarnath.
I thought you. So at this temple, you were by yourself, and you ran into. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Except for this lady who was determined to follow along. Yeah. It was wonderfully Indian, kind of just absolutely no control.
Remember staying at his description of hotels is great, because I remember we had stayed at a hotel in Bhopal,
right,
where they had this Union Carbide disaster in the 1980s or something. And there was a giant rat under the bed. And anytime we turn the lights out, we just come out immediately and just start wandering around. And when we turn the lights on, we just slowly go back under the bed. So we just left the lights on all night. Right outside, there was this wedding with like drums and whatever, fireworks or something. Just couldn't sleep.
I can imagine that. What's his name again?
Manu. When he saw the rat, he's like, you have to be kidding me.
It was Indian, and he's having to deal with India is way too much for him. way out of his comfort zone.